How do you feel when you switch to Geico and save on your car insurance? It's like going to work on one Thursday morning and thinking to yourself, just one more day until Friday. But then somebody in the elevator says, Happy Friday! Then you check your phone quickly and discover today is actually Friday. So yes, Happy Friday, random stranger in the elevator. Happy Friday indeed. Yep, switching and saving with Geico feels just like that. Get more with Geico. How do you feel when you switch to Geico and save on your car insurance? It's like going to work on one Thursday morning and thinking to yourself, just one more day until Friday. But then somebody in the elevator says, Happy Friday! Then you check your phone quickly and discover today is actually Friday. So yes, Happy Friday, random stranger in the elevator. Happy Friday indeed. Yep, switching and saving with Geico feels just like that. Get more with Geico.
Dress, the History of Fashion is a production of Dressed Media. With over 8 billion people in the world, we all have one thing in common. Every day, we all get dressed.
Welcome to Dressed, the History of Fashion, a podcast where we explore the who, what, when of why we wear. We are fashion historians and your hosts, April Callahan
and Cassidy Zachary. April, how many costume designers can say they lost the Oscar for best costume design to themselves?
Okay, well, you being the former film, TV, movie costume person, you're the expert on this, so I have no clue.
Well, let's just say that is exactly the case with today's guest, Sandy Powell, one of the most decorated and sought-after costume designers living and working today. And Sandy's career spans an incredible 40 years, 50-plus films. She's earned the highest honors, including the title of Officer of the Most Excellent Order of the British Empire, or OBE. And she has an incredible 16 BAFTAs, and BAFTAs are the British Academy Film Awards. She has 15 Academy Awards, and these are all nominations, so 16 and 15 nominations, and she's won 3 of each. And this is a fun fact. Her first BAFTA and Oscar wins came in the same year in 1998 when she was nominated at each Academy's awards for her designs for not one, but 2 films. So she took home the Oscar for Shakespeare in Love and the BAFTA for Velvet Goldmine.
I mean, I think that this is maybe not the first time that we've had an Academy Award winner on the show, but she definitely takes the cake.
Yeah.
And this was not the first nor the last time Sandy would compete against herself for these awards throughout her career. And when you start to look at her resume and all the films, it's clear why. Just a few of the Sandy Powell designed films that you may have heard of include Interview with a Vampire, The Wings of the Dove, Gangs of New York, The Aviator, The Other Boleyn Girl, 2015's version of Cinderella, and my personal favorite, The Favorite. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. And also Interview with a Vampire is one of my all-time favorite films as well. And all of these films attest to the fact that fashion history really plays a significant role in Sandy's work, as no period has been left untouched by her. She's really this sort of time-traveling costume designer par excellence.
Yes, and I'm sure I am not alone when I say that my introduction to the magic of costume design and really recognizing the storytelling capabilities of costumes came largely thanks to my exposure to Sandy's films from a very young age. She has an incredibly special and unique gift to create a dressed world that is at once in service of the story and then also a character in its own right. And it is this gift which makes her one of the most celebrated costume designers working today, and the reason that she is the subject of the first retrospective exhibition of her work.
Sandy Powell's Dressing the Part costume design for film has been curated by Rafael Gomez and is now on view at the SCAD Fash Museum of Fashion and Film in Atlanta. And it's up now until March 16th, 2025. So you have some months to go and see it and check it out. And in celebration of this exhibition and project, we are so pleased to welcome Sandy to Dressed.
Sandy, welcome to Dressed. It is such an honor to have you here with me today.
Thank you, Cassidy. I'm thrilled to be here.
And we are here to celebrate the first retrospective of your work with a look back at your career. But first, I would actually love to go back to where it all started for you and just learn a little bit about your formative years. I love to ask people this question on Dressed, but do you have an earliest memory of clothing from your youth?
It's a difficult one to answer, but I can definitely say I was interested in clothes from a really young age. I just always liked clothes, but I was also around them being made for me by my mother. I was brought up in the 60s. I was born in 1960. And back then, it was quite common for people to make their own clothes. And my mother, I think she must have taught herself how to sew, but she used to make clothes, dresses really, for myself and my younger sister. So I was always fascinated with the whole process of going to the department store to choose the fabric, and then flicking through the pattern books and picking a pattern, and then watching her cut it out and use the machine. And I think I was as young as, what, 4 or 5 at that stage, and I wanted to know how to do it myself. And I remember having a go, apparently, one day I was caught cutting up a skirt of hers to try and turn into something for myself. But she did teach me to sew hand stitch, and I had dolls, and I started out by making dolls' clothes. So I don't know whether that answers the question necessarily, but from a very young age, I was really interested in clothes and the construction and the colors and the patterns and the fabrics.
And to be such a central part in your mother's dressmaking process too, that she included you in that process, is really special.
Yeah, it was.
And was there a spark that maybe ignited your interest in the storytelling capabilities of clothing, or your interest in the art of costume design?
I think for most of my childhood and teen years, it was more about early teens. It was more about fashion and clothes and just dressing, although I liked to dress up. So I guess I was a bit of a show-off as well, or an exhibitionist. I liked clothes to be noticed, I suppose. And maybe at the time, I didn't realize that there actually was a career to be had in doing clothes for telling story purposes in theatre and film. But I liked films and I liked the theatre. And I suppose the first film that I saw that really made me think about clothes was, I was in my teens, and I saw Death in Venice when I was about 14, and looked at the costumes designed by the great Piero Tosi, and just love them. That was very formative. But actually, the moment that I really realized that I wanted to work in the world was when I saw a piece of theater called Flowers, which was a piece of sort of dance, I guess you call it dance, mime. It was everything by a director, choreographer, dancer called Lindsay Kemp in the 1970s, in the mid-1970s. And Lindsay Kemp, I'd heard about because I'd read that he'd taught David Bowie during his sort of Ziggy Stardust years, and then also went on to work with Kate Bush. So I'd heard about this extraordinary figure, and having been a huge David Bowie fan, the minute I saw that he had a show in London, I went to see it. And it was actually sitting in the darkened theatre watching this spectacle unfurl that really, that was the moment that changed my life. And I knew I wanted to work in theatre. Having said that, I didn't think, oh, I'm desperate to do costumes in theatre. I wanted to work in the theatre.
Yeah. I mean, there's nothing really quite like when you're young and sitting in a dark theater and seeing a live performance piece. I don't think there's anything like it. It's not replicated in film to be young and to see a stage performance, I think, especially one that you still remember to this day.
No, I remember how it made me feel, certain moments, how it made me feel. And there is a magic that actually only happens in live theater that, as you say, cannot be captured on film.
I had the same experience seeing Cinderella when I was maybe 5 or 6. And that really helped set me on my trajectory in many ways. But Lindsay has actually said of that performance, Flowers, I love this quote from him. He said, "Flowers was a miracle, the most famous and fabulous of my productions. It was also the most unplanned. I just spontaneously followed the free flow of my inspirations, and magically it awakened a chord, an unforgettable chord, and God knows how many hundreds of thousands of people all over the globe." He said it opened so many doors for me, and I know for countless people throughout the 70s and 80s. And I think it's really special that you were one of those people, especially because you will go on to work with him.
I can't believe how lucky I've been. Yeah, absolutely. So I saw that one show, and then I think I went back a couple more times. I was still at school then. And I managed to go back a couple of times and then saw something else. And then it wasn't until I was studying during my second year of theatre design at Central School of Art and Design, where I was doing theatre design, which involved designing sets and costumes. And I noticed, I mean, Lindsay can't maybe point out, but Lindsay didn't actually live in, even though he's British, he did not live in the UK. He lived in Spain at the time. And the kind of work that he did, it wasn't not accepted in the UK, but it was much more appreciated in Europe. And his company were made up of performers from around the globe. It was a totally international company. Anyhow, I knew he didn't live in the UK, but then I noticed that he was teaching dance classes at a dance place called the Pineapple Dance Centre in London's Covent Garden. And so I took myself off. I thought, okay, that's it. I'm going to go and do a dance class with Lindsay Kemp, which I did. And it wasn't by any means your conventional dance class. It was very free form. And that quote you say was quite interesting because I can just hear him saying it. And it very much seemed to be make it up as you go along. You'd play a piece of music and then we'd have to waltz around the room and pretend to be a cherry blossom. Or you had to pretend to fall in love with the person next to you. I mean, it's excruciatingly embarrassing, but after a while, you just had to get into it. And at the end of that class, I approached him and I said, look, I saw your work, first of all, a few years ago when I was at school, and it inspired me to do theatre design. And I'd love to show you some of my work, not that I had much. And he was lovely. And he said, okay. He invited me. I think he invited me to tea at the place he was staying. And I took a few drawings, which is all I had. And he pretty much took me under his wing. And I carried on doing classes for the rest of that summer. And we sort of became friends. And he said, oh, yes, come and work with me. And it's sort of a wild offer that I accepted. He didn't actually give me a job, but I decided to not go back to school. I called them and I said, listen, I want to have a year off before graduating, before doing my final year. I'd like to have a sabbatical year, which they agreed to. I took that year off. I did end up working with him and I never went back.
And I love that story because it really shows, especially to our listeners, there's no one trajectory to costume design. We talk about this all the time on the show, but you don't have to go to school and get a degree. And there's all these different ways that people come to their careers. And I think yours is particularly fascinating in that you went to school, left, and then embarked on what will become this remarkable career.
I have to say, I talk to students quite a lot, and I don't want to say you don't have to go to college to do this. You don't. But equally, it's useful to go to college if you know why you're there and you can use the facilities. Yes. And you can use that as a place to learn and expand on your interests. I didn't do a great deal of work when I was at college, but I did have one great teacher who only taught us for like a couple of hours a week. And that was historical pattern cutting. And I think that was the most valuable thing I learned whilst there. Plus, actually being involved in putting on shows and putting on performances. But I think if I'd stayed, I think I might have failed my degree miserably.
Not for everybody.
I think I spent more time socializing, but it did whet my appetite. It did make me realize this is what I wanted to do. Not against it totally, but you certainly don't need to have a piece of paper with a qualification on it.
Right, absolutely. And then how long did you design with Lindsay before you made your way into film?
Let me say, I think back then, obviously time was longer. Time didn't go as fast as it does now. And so I was 20? I was 20 or 21 when I met him. And then I worked with him and with some other theatre companies. And then my first film was when I met Derek Jarman in 84. So, I mean, really probably only 3 or 4 years. But then I did continue to work with him after I started in film. I did do a couple of other projects. But it was really only 3 or 4 years maximum that I did 2 or 3 shows with him. Plus, I was doing theatre in London as well.
But I think learning about your work with Lindsay makes sense, too, in terms of when you went on to work with Derek Jarman, because both of these are incredibly important artists who are working outside of the box, essentially, in terms of what they're doing and what they're producing. Can you talk about your work with Derek throughout the 1980s and then into the early 90s?
Yeah, it was very similar to when I was working with Lindsay. And then, of course, Lindsay had appeared in a couple of Derek Jarman films anyway. So there was that connection already. They work in similar ways. I mean, Derek always appeared to be free flow in the same way as Lindsay was, although that's the impression they give. But actually, they do know what they're doing. They do know what they want to achieve, but it just feels a lot freer and a lot less disciplined in a way than directors I've worked with since. They're both artists in the real true sense of the word. I mean, they were both painters and they could both design. So that sort of really made a difference. But how can I mean, Lindsay, they both taught me a lot. Lindsay taught me a lot about making the clothes and the costumes feel real. I mean, he was very much into painting and breaking down, and he loved rags and tatters and costumes that had a life. And then the work I did with Derek was similar. I mean, Derek's films were never set in a particular period. They were always, I guess, what we call timeless, where it was whatever felt right for the character or the scene at the time. We didn't really think about it too much.
I think Derek's films are really interesting too, because at least in the ones that I've seen, the backdrops are almost spare, or they're not, like as you said, it's not specific to a place and time necessarily. And so I think your costumes, because of that, really stand out and shine.
I think also, I mean, I love sets where they're abstract and where it doesn't show every detail, because I also think it gives the audience a chance to imagine what they want it to be and what it should be. And I think it's great not having everything served up on a plate, not every tiny detail. It was more expressionistic, I suppose. And yes, I suppose it really does give the costumes the chance to help tell the story, which they should be doing anyway. I'm not saying the costume should be more noticeable than the sets or the background, but it really focuses on the actors and the performance and the storytelling in that sense.
And I think it's so wonderful. You have several costume designs from these early films featured in the exhibition, which when you learn about what happens to film costumes after productions, sometimes they go in a box, sometimes they're rented out for years and years and years, that there are so many pieces in this exhibition is wonderful. And then to have some of these early pieces, because you have a piece from your very first film with Derek, which is Caravaggio from 1986. That's the very first thing that we see when we walk into the exhibition.
I know, I'm very lucky to have that. In fact, I had more. I had two or three costumes from that, and they've disappeared over the years. So I must have taken them at the end of the film because no one knew what to do with them, and I took them. And back then, this was in the 80s, they were stuffed away in a corner in my one-roomed flat in London and brought out for parties. We used to dress up in them, would you believe, to go to parties and go out. So it's amazing that this one has survived. Really sadly, the dress that Hilda wears in the party scene in it has disappeared. And that I had that for years, and then it just disappeared somewhere along the line. Don't know where that is, but yeah, it's amazing that has survived, and I'm glad I did manage to keep hold of it. And the costumes from Wittgenstein also. I can't believe how those five outfits have survived, because they've certainly been out at many a party.
Well, it makes sense now that we learned that it's in your personal collection.
Yeah.
And can we talk a little bit more about that first film? Because you've talked about this in numerous interviews, how you didn't really know what you were doing. Can you tell us a little bit about that experience and what that was like for you coming from the world of theater into the world of film?
The world of theater that I came from wasn't the conventional theater that most people think of. I never once actually designed the costumes for a play, a regular play. It was either dance related, or the theater companies that I worked for in London were they called? They were sort of experimental visual theater. And there was a lot of that in the early 80s, because there was a lot of money from the Arts Council funding all these companies. So they were very sort of mixed media, a lot of dance, but they were sort of improvised a lot of the time, and they weren't straight plays. So then moving into a Derek Jarman film was moving just one step further in that same direction, as opposed to it wasn't a complete shock. But on Caravaggio, I mean, there was a script and there was a story, and Derek had already said, we're not sticking to the period that the characters were going to be set in, was going to be somewhere vaguely 1940s, because one of the visual references he gave were the Italian neorealists. One of the films we watched was The Bicycle Thieves, which was amazing. And it was that sort of very Italian men wearing suits they've been wearing every day for years that were covered in dust and tired clothes, but that also have a romanticism. So I knew the kind of look that we had to get, and we found some things, we rented some things. And then the one scene in the film that looks vaguely period was a fancy dress party that we were going to set in the Jacobean period, roughly. And that's where we made the crossing to the principals. But I didn't know, once we started shooting, what you were meant to do. We were set up in a warehouse in Limehouse, an area of London back then that was just had old warehouses on the river, which is now, of course, totally developed with luxury apartments. But back then, there was a dirty old warehouse that wasn't soundproofed at all. And down one end, they built the set for Caravaggio, and the other end were the various workshops and where the scenery was painted. And we had a wardrobe space at the other end, and where we just set up, and myself and my assistant, Annie Simons, who is also a costume designer now, would sit and make the costumes ourselves as we went along. And then it was an extraordinary experience where the people who were painting the sets, once they'd finished painting the sets, they'd come in and help make the costume. The actors would just hang out there, and if there's anything for them to do, they would help out. And it was very much like that. I didn't even know that once we started shooting, that we had to have somebody on the set watching. I just thought, just get everyone dressed in the morning, send right. them off. They make a film. And I guess I must have spent a little bit of time on set, but really we were too busy. We had too much to do to be on set. It felt very free fall, but it wasn't. There were people there who were a bit more experienced than us who kept it all together. But it was a fantastic experience. And what was amazing about Derek was that he gave everybody the freedom. He must have been guiding us in his own way. He obviously was. But he also took the risk of trusting a bunch of 25-year-olds. That was the average age of everybody on that film.
That's amazing. And you read about Derek, too, how he created this family-like atmosphere.
It was the same group of people that went on to do 3 or 4 more films with him. Tilda Swinton talks about it. It was a family, and we all grew up together. We were very, very lucky.
And that was Tilda's first film, right? It was Caravaggio.
It was. Yeah, it was most people's first film on that. It was incredible.
And I love learning about these formative years, because I think a lot of this atmosphere that you're describing and what Derek and both Lindsay supported and cultivated in you will play out throughout the rest of your career into today. And within 6 years of your feature film debut, you received your first American and British Academy Award nominations for your designs for Sally Potter's gender and time-traversing historic epic, Orlando, released in 1992, one of my absolute favorite films, especially because of the costume design. Can you talk about your approach to the costumes for this film and how they represented your evolution as a designer up to that point? Because really, within a matter of years, you're doing this big historic epic when before, like you, as you said, you were in a warehouse making your own costumes along with your assistant.
I suppose the thing about Orlando is that it looks like it's huge and epic because it covers multiple decades, centuries even. It's actually not that big. A film. Mm-hmm. It's actually got only a handful of characters, and we don't have huge crowd scenes. There's a couple. There's at the beginning of the Elizabethan court, and then the next big scenes are, I think, in the wars, where there's those scenes that we actually shot those in Uzbekistan. So compared to what I've done since, it's actually a very small contained film, but obviously it was the biggest thing I'd done to date, because Derek Jarman films didn't really have extras or didn't have crowds of people in. I think I'd done a couple of films in between the Jarmans and the Sally Potter. Yes, I did. That did have extras. So I was learning a little bit more about the scale of things. Working on it was, that felt very much like working on a Derek Jarman film with a bit more money. Sally, again, is an artist, and she knew very much what she wanted and was very instrumental in providing a lot of imagery. So she was very clear. And I think we were all quite clear of how it was going to look in terms of how we went from one period to another. And we were all looking at the same reference images for each of Tilda's looks in particular. So it was a sort of continuation, really. It felt like a natural continuation from Derek Jarman to Orlando.
And for listeners who have not seen that film, watch it. It's so visually stunning, among many other things. But essentially, Tilda Swinton, it starts off, I think, in the 1500s, and she starts off as a man. And then throughout time, she moves forward in time over something like 500 years, and by the end is a woman. So you have this huge breadth of time. And again, several of these costumes are featured in the exhibition, including her beautiful 18th century ball gown, and then Quentin Crisp's. That was a real treat to see. Quentin Crisp played Elizabeth I And to see the detail that was put onto that costume, all of the hand-painted eyes, was just such a treat to see in person. Yeah. And then again, just throughout my research, I didn't realize it was also photographed by Karl Lagerfeld for Vogue in 1993.
Well, not the whole film, but yes, we went actually, Tilda, myself, and the hair and makeup team went to Paris for a day with some of the costumes. And yeah, I didn't even realize that Karl Lagerfeld was actually taking the photographs. And we actually went to his amazing home. That was like a palace. That was the location where he shot her. He shot her wearing some of her costumes.
Yeah.
For the Vogue shoot. You're right. I forgot about that.
Yeah. I'll post some of the images, dress listeners, because they're absolutely fantastic. And not the first crossover into fashion that you will have, by the way, but maybe we'll talk about that a little bit more in a minute. So you'll only continue to hone your skills throughout the 90s, and you continue to get accolades for your work. In 1998, you famously compete with yourself at both the American and British Academy Awards, also known as the BAFTAs. You're nominated for Shakespeare in Love and Velvet Goldmine. And these films could perhaps not be more aesthetically different in terms of 16th century Shakespeare versus 1970s glam rock, but really they're both such a reflection of your supreme mastery of the art form of storytelling through dress. And I'm hoping that we can maybe use these films as a lens to get a better understanding of your research process and how you begin to formulate your designs when you start a project. And does that change based on the type of project?
I think the process is usually the same. Now, back then, what the difference is from researching both those films in the mid-90s is this was pre-internet, really, or pre-internet that we were all using all of the time. We just didn't use it for that thing, but in the same way as it universally used now. So the research starts in the same way by looking at the period, actually just looking at the period. So for Shakespeare in Love, obviously, it was an Elizabethan period, and we're looking at paintings and portraits, and the only people who got their portraits painted were wealthy people. So to research poorer types, you have to look into other things. There are some images, there are paintings of poorer or more working class people, and also reading as much as possible. I think I also probably looked at other films set in the period. It's very difficult, actually, because I can't remember because it's so long ago now.
Right.
We're talking over 30 years ago. And Velvet Goldmine was, in a sense, easier because we have photography to look at. It's just gathering together all the images. And then the thing that I love doing, really, straight after compiling the reference images, is looking for fabrics. And I actually quite often buy the fabrics before I know what I'm going to do with them. I buy the fabric that appeals, or the color that appeals, or the texture appeals. And then I think, okay, what does this piece of fabric tell me? What does it want to be made into? And I, as much as I have a sort of an array of images to look at, the fabric swatches are really important. I kind of mess around with those before actually deciding what's going to happen to them all.
And is there a favorite period you have in fashion history, or that you've enjoyed the most researching throughout your career?
No, this is a question I get asked a lot. There are some periods that I haven't worked on. You know, lots of periods I haven't worked on. But you might think, oh, don't think that's very interesting. But as soon as you start looking into something, as soon as you start researching something and working in it, you find fascinating and interesting things to do. And so there's not a period I haven't enjoyed working in. And what happens on every occasion, by the time you get to the end of the film, you're having more and more ideas. You're realizing, oh, I didn't get to do that. And I wished I'd thought of that back then when I had to make that costume. So it's almost like you finish something and you're ready to do it all again, or do another film in the exact same period to do all the things you couldn't do in the first go at doing that period. There's no favorite. I enjoy Elizabethan as much as I enjoy 1930s, really.
And is it true that for Wings of the Dove, you actually convinced the director to change the period?
I think we did. Yeah, I think I did. It was meant to be slightly earlier. Now, I wish I could remember why. Yes, it was meant to be more Edwardian. And I can't remember why. I wish I could remember why. And I can't remember whether it was because, oh, I do know why. I think because it had Helena Bonham Carter in it. And it was a slightly earlier period. And back then, there were all of those Merchant Ivory films that Helena was well known
yes.
for being in, which were the
corset
dramas. They were incredibly popular. And Helena made her name in those. And I said to Ian, should we just try and make it a little bit different? If we just push it a couple of years when the corsetry wasn't quite so heavy, it was just women just coming out of that, heading towards the 20s when they lost them all together, a sort of a freer, a different silhouette. Well, let's just go for a different silhouette. It might be more interesting. I don't know whether that was the entire reason why we set it in about 1913 or something around about then. Or not, but I do remember thinking, I don't really want to have Helena Bonham Carter looking like she's always looked in a Merchant Ivory film.
I mean, and for us fashion history nerds, that is a very significant shift that happens from those S-bend Edwardian corsets to around 1912, 1913. It's a dramatic shift in fashion. And fashion, yes. That's my favorite period in fashion history because it's so fascinating how much has changed in just those few short years. And again, you incorporated the kind of the Orientalist influence of the period, the ballet russe. You have so much more to play with, I think, in terms of that period too.
Exactly. That's what I thought. You could really play with those silhouettes. And then you still have the older characters who would be corseted. And then if you think about it, then just a few years later, when it goes into the 20s, I mean, it's so extreme, isn't it? I mean, imagine being around in the mid-20s and then just 20 years earlier was so completely different.
Yeah.
And I think about that often. There hadn't been a change as dramatic as that, apart from possibly punks in the 70s. Mm-hmm. But there's been nothing since. There's been nothing since then that has been such a dramatic change. Because I think about now and 20 years ago, not that different. I can't think of anything in fashion now that is wildly different from 20 years ago. There's nothing. I keep thinking, when is there going to be something shockingly different? And maybe we've done it all. Yeah, I don't know.
I think we have, to an extent. You know, all the fashions from the 90s and early 2000s are coming back. So it's only been 20 years.
Oh, no, that's terrifying.
Yeah, it's, and so I don't know. That's a great question.
Yeah.
I was really pleased to see the Wings of the Dove costumes. And you talked about, there's this beautiful kimono on view that has a beautiful embroidered peacock on the back. And you talked about how that peacock was white and you painted it, which I thought was just extraordinary.
Yes, kimono was a vintage piece, not as old as 1913, but it was a vintage piece and it was a beautiful peacock, but it was in white. And we knew that the scene I used it for, which was a party scene, we knew that that was being filmed in a location called Leighton House, which is a sort of fabulous house in London. And there is a room in it, and I believe it's called the Peacock Room because it's completely tiled with gorgeous sort of peacock-coloured tiles, like blues and greens and purples. And so I try to make the colours of the party work with that, and I definitely could control what I did with Helena's costume. So she had a blue, fortune-y pleated dress, and I needed something to go over the top, and I found the kimono with the white peacock, and so we just painted colour into the white embroidery piece and added a few sequins.
And listeners hopefully are starting a list of films to watch if they have not seen them already. Dress listeners, holiday shopping season tis upon us, and Rakuten is the best way to save lots of money this holiday season. Why? That's because you can stack holiday sales and deals on top of Rakuten's cashback program to maximize your savings at 3,500 stores.
How does it work? Well, your favorite stores pay Rakuten to send them shoppers, and Rakuten passes some of that money directly onto their members via cashback, by PayPal, or a check.
And this holiday season, cashback rates will be the highest of the year, up to 15% depending on the store. And we are talking across every single category, including fashion, beauty, electronics, home essentials, travel, and dining.
As a pet owner, I especially love the fact that I can get cash back at PetSmart and Chewy when I shop them via Rakuten. Membership is free and it's easy to sign up. Join the 17 million members who are already saving. Start all of your holiday shopping at Rakuten.com or download the Rakuten app to start saving today. Your cash back really adds up. Us ladies have all been there. Feeling a smidge off the days before your cycle is something that we have all experienced at one point or another. For some of us, it's occasional. For others, it's a monthly battle.
Which is why Happy Mammoth has created Estro Control, a capsule containing science-backed herbal extracts that help support hormonal health, especially in women who suffer from PMS.
The way estrogen control eases PMS is quite interesting. The ingredients help support the liver, and that's where our hormones get processed, especially estrogen. So when the estrogen isn't processed well in the liver, this can potentially trigger PMS.
Estro control is made specifically for women who are premenopausal, so it's perfect for women that haven't entered menopause yet. In fact, it's amazing for perimenopause, when hormones start to fluctuate and PMS can hit hard.
For a limited time, you can get 15% off on your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code DRESSED at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code DRESSED for 15% off today.
How do you feel when you switch to Geico and save on your car insurance? It's like going to work on one Thursday morning and thinking to yourself, just one more day until Friday. But then somebody in the elevator says, Happy Friday! Then you check your phone quickly and discover today is actually Friday. So yes, Happy Friday, random stranger in the elevator. Happy Friday indeed. Yep, switching and saving with Geico feels just like that. Get more with Geico.
Fashion history plays a significant role in your work, but complete historical accuracy is not necessarily always the goal for you when designing. It doesn't always serve the needs of this script. Can you talk about how you have to negotiate artistic license with historical accuracy in your storytelling? This really is an art form that you in particular have mastered, I have to say, and was done to brilliant effect in The Favorite, but also a number of your films.
It's a difficult one, that, because of course, most of the films I do, I'd say 99% of the films I do are period. So at the beginning of every film, I research the actual period and I want to know as much as possible. And on one hand, you want to make it as correct as possible, but then I don't want to get bogged down by being absolutely historically correct, because even if I wanted to be, I actually believe it's impossible. If you're especially on something centuries ago, I mean, maybe it probably would be possible to do the 20th century as accurate as possible, but only in as far as finding the right fabrics. And even now, it's difficult to actually, having said that, that's completely wrong. I mean, even now, if I was doing a film set in the 1950s or the 1940s and having to make a men's suit, it's almost impossible to find the right kind of wool to make a suit from the 1940s, because it's just not made in the same way. You just can't find it. Tailoring has changed so much. And men's suiting is now manufactured for comfort. It's now soft and light and comfortable, right, and not heavy. And it's not built to last the lifetime. It's built to last a couple of seasons, perhaps, or a couple of years. And it just looks completely different. So in a way, because I know that I cannot get the exact materials that would make something historically accurate, you've just got to sort of, in a way, throw that out of the window a bit or not get too concerned about it, and do the best you can with what you have. And it also depends on the nature of the film and the director's vision. And if the film is slightly stylized, then you've got room for artistic license. And I think also it's just a nice way of putting your own mark on something, rather than copying exactly what's already been done, is doing another version of it, but maintaining an element of the period, still sort of being true to the period in a sense. I mean, I always maintain that really we're not making a documentary. It's entertainment and telling a story. So I do the best that I can to tell the story without it being distractingly wrong. I don't consciously go out of my way to do a modern version of something. I'm not necessarily doing the modern version of something.
Yeah,
I'm doing the best I can with what I've got in and making it how I think it should look. I think, and even if I was trying to do be absolutely 100% historically accurate, in 20, 30, 40 years' time, you could watch that film and somebody will be able to date it exactly. You always can date a film from when it was made. Even going back to Death in Venice, the Piero Tosi film I saw in the 70s that was set in the turn of the century with the huge hats, that was set in a similar period to Wings of the Dove, wasn't it? Just slightly earlier. You can still tell it was made in the set, even though the costumes are beautiful. And you think, oh my God, they're so accurate. You look again and you can, there is something about it that you can tell it was made in the early 70s because of the fabrics that were chosen or because of the colours that were fashionable at the time. You could just always date when something was made, even though you're trying to be accurate.
And hair and makeup, I will say, plays a big part in that too, because I love looking, especially the 1960s, you look at historic films from the 1960s, and the women have their bouffant hairstyles.
Yeah, they have the hair, and they have the Elizabeth Taylor in Cleopatra with pointy bosoms.
Yeah.
It's with a conical bra. You can always date it anyway.
But that's not to say that audiences necessarily would have noticed at the time. And people talk about that a lot, and that you're also catering to your audience. And almost to be 100% historically accurate with no makeup and historically accurate hairstyles could sometimes take an audience out of the film, and you want them to be in the film. But something I just so appreciated about The Favorite is you do clearly take a departure from quote unquote historical accuracy, not in the silhouettes, because the silhouettes situate it in that period, but you use color and fabric in such an incredible way. Can you talk a little bit more about what you did with color and materials in that film? Because I think it's really fascinating when you learn you didn't have a huge budget and you were actually incredibly creative with what you achieved.
Maybe it was set in 1708, which is a strange period. And I realized that not many films have been set in that period, and not many plays are in that period. So, you know, on a film that scale where you have extras, you generally go and rent all your crowd costumes. So you would generally be renting your costumes for the court. Whereas in Shakespeare in Love, the Elizabethan court, there were between London and Italy and Spain and the costume houses, there were quite a few Elizabethan costumes that have been made for various productions over the years that when you got them all together looked okay. You could put them quite comfortably on your extras. For this, there was absolutely nothing. There was really nothing at all. And it would mean either going earlier or later or mixing up the periods. And I just thought, it's going to look a hot mess. It's just going to be horrible. How on earth am I going to create these costumes for this number of people in such a limited time period? We had a very short prep time. And we had a very limited budget. So I thought, I'm going to have to make everything. Then it was like, how can I make that in the time? And how can I afford to buy the kind of fabric that would normally be used in a court? And one of my main influences and inspirations was a film called The Draftsman's Contract, which was made in the early 80s by Peter Greenaway. And it's set just a bit earlier. It's set in the late 1600s, absolutely stunning piece of work. And all of the costumes were black and white. And I just thought it was the most gorgeous thing. And then a bit later on, I think I saw that when I was at college still. And then a bit later on, I saw an exhibition of the costumes and I was amazed to see that they were made out of muslin and cotton canvas.
Wow.
There was not one fancy fabric at all. They were all cotton, but the detail was gorgeous. And the cut was really accurate. And so, you know, it wasn't an original idea I had to make them black and white. I kind of looked at that, it looked really gorgeous. And I thought, I need to make them out of plain fabrics and cut out all the embellishment because we can't afford the embellishment. We haven't got time to do the embellishment, which was be embroidery, bejeweling and all of that. I couldn't afford to buy brocades and velvets and silks and satins. So I thought, okay, I'm going to have a go at doing the same thing. I'm just going to use cotton, affordable fabrics, but then employ the best costume makers and cutters to cut exquisite silhouettes, which is what we did. And also cutting down on the color, cutting back on the color, which on one hand is a difficult thing for me to do because I absolutely love color. But it also made it a lot easier to do the fabric sampling and swatching. And it also cut down on the time I would normally take to dye all the colors the exact shade that I wanted. It was out of necessity, but in the end worked.
Incredibly well. I mean, those costumes are absolutely stunning. They live rent-free in my head, and you get to see so many of them up close in person in the exhibition and see what you're talking about in terms of the fabrics and then the laser cut lace and really just, I mean, Emma Stone's blue denim corset is just a feat of dressmaking when you look at how impeccably constructed these pieces are. And that leads me right into my next question, which is about the role of your team and bringing your visions to life, because you really work with the best artisans in their field.
I have been lucky enough to, yes. The team is crucial. I couldn't do it on my own at all. And over the years, I've worked with some real artists, people who have taught me a lot as well. And I depend absolutely entirely on them to help produce the costumes. And the cutter is the person I probably work closest with, other than, of course, my actual assistants. And the buyer is another important person, my shopper and buyer and the people who go out looking for fabrics. But the cutter, I really enjoy working with, and I enjoy watching how they build. I don't like working flat. When I learned to do period pattern cutting, we learned to do it in 3D on the mannequin, draping, pinning the fabric, draping, and then cutting the pattern from that. And that's how I like to work with a cutter, because you can actually get an idea in your head of the shape and the scale before it's actually stitched together. The craftspeople are absolutely crucial. And also your relationship with them is crucial. Yeah. To actually be able to communicate what it is you want them to do. But so much of the time, I will give my cutter a pile of reference images. I will give them an idea of a silhouette. We all play with the fabric together. But then I will allow them the freedom to come up with suggestions. I don't provide an accurate drawing with every seam on it and say, do this. It's a two-way thing. And then I come back and forth whilst it's being done.
Lots of similarities with fashion designers too, historically. So a lot of fashion designers work too. Yeah. And it's very much a collaborative process, which I love. And I want to highlight just a couple specific pieces that really exemplify the artistry of your team from the exhibition. And the first is the group of Mary Poppins costumes. Can you talk a little bit about those? Because those, I think those are one of those costumes that I actually found almost to be more stunning in person, because I had no idea what they actually looked like versus the kind of Trump loyal effect that they achieved on film. It was really fascinating to see those up close in person.
Yeah, they are one of my favorites. Interestingly, I worked on that at the same time as The Favorite.
Oh, interesting.
I had two workrooms going in the same studio at the same time. I'd already designed Mary Poppins. The costumes were designed and they were being made at the same time as I started working on The Favorite. So that was one of those times where I was running between one film and the other, and they couldn't have been more different. It was an interesting experience. But the 2D costumes, or what I call the 2D painted costumes, were at the very beginning of the film when we had the script. We knew that there was going to be an animated sequence in the same way as a reference to the original supercalifragilistic scene in the original Mary Poppins, with the animated animals and then the live action. And I don't know why, it just came to me and I thought, why don't we try to make the actors look as if they're part of the animation, as opposed to have them stand really outside of it? Because when I took a look at the original film, which is amazing, which is fabulous anyway, it looks a little clunky, and the animated look very animated and the real look very villain. I knew it was still going to be the same thing, but I wanted the live action, the live characters, to sort of work in the animated world. So I suggested we try to make them look as if they've been painted as well. And I work with an incredibly talented group of painters, textile artists, who for, you know, a good few weeks, we just did sample testing of like paint effects and techniques. I also got the Disney animators to send me some examples of the kind of techniques they'd be using, or the kind of paint effects they'd be using, so it wouldn't look out of place. And then I made all the costumes were then made out of canvas and calico and muslin, and then painted. Now, some of it, the pattern pieces were cut out. We had to work out in advance which bits needed to be painted completely flat, and then which bits could be painted once the costumes had been made up. And I think that most of the pieces were marked out. The pattern pieces were marked out, and then the painters would have to paint what they could. And then the costumes were sewn up. And then once they were made into 3D things, they were put back on the mannequins and then painted into again with the shading. And it was a big experiment, actually. I didn't really know whether it was going to work, but it worked incredibly well. But as you say, it was really, I was really surprised when I saw them on the mannequin standing there. You just stand back a little bit and they look like cutouts. They look like cardboard cutouts. They do not look 3D, but they are.
And the fact that you achieved that without special effects, right? I mean, we have all of these things at our fingertips right now, but the fact that artisans with their own two hands achieved that effect. And that's an interesting thing about film too, is because that was probably filmed on a green screen, right? So you wouldn't have seen the full effect and the success of that effect.
No, we didn't see it not until the film was finished. I didn't see any of it,
And then one other costume I wanted to highlight in terms of your team was the Cinderella dress, which is on view, and which looks like it's lit from below. It looks like it's shimmering, but it's not. That's the effect of the fabric used. And this dress actually holds a Guinness World Record. Most fabric used in a movie costume, including multiples. It's just incredible that 18 people, 550 hours to make each of these dresses, which each used 273 yards of fabric for a total of 2,184 yards. So half the length of a football field goes into these dresses.
It was many layers of very fine fabric, I suppose. The effect really of the color and the shimmery was the order of layers of the fabric, which we played around with. I just had lots of lengths of fabric of the colors and the lightness, and the top layers are the finest layers of the fabric called Umissima, which is a polyester, but it's if you throw it into the air, it's like oil or smoke. Very fine. But then underneath that, there were some cheaper fabrics. There was a very cheap iridescent taffeta fabric that actually lit really well. And you could lick through the other Umissima layers. The Umissima layers are three different colors. There was a sort of a greeny blue, a purpley blue, and a blue. And they all move separately from each other. I wanted it to look like there was a movement of color as opposed to one solid color. And that's what the layers did. And then the dress in itself is a feat of structural engineering. The way that it does move and the way that it just settles back exactly how it should do every time, you know, in the ballroom scene, in the dance. Particularly, it's incredible how she'll jump and twirl and then land and it just all settles.
And to have been tasked with creating such an iconic dress in terms of film history, in terms of people's imaginations, right? People have an idea of what Cinderella should look like. So for you to recreate that and to do it in such an exceptional way was so incredible. And I thought it was really important too that Lily James, who plays Cinderella, talks about how that dress is what kind of empowered her to take on that role. I mean, you play such an important part in the actors' experiences in these films and roles too. And that actually leads me into a question about how you choose your projects, because I find that there's always something so magical and whimsical about a lot of the projects that you do choose. Is that intentional, or how do you pick what projects you want to work on?
The first thing is usually the script, but unless it's a director who I've worked with before and I really like and have a relationship with, if a director I've worked before asks me to work with them, I will say yes, probably regardless of what it is, because I know that whatever it is going to be a good quality film. But I make my choices really from the script and whether I like the script and whether I think it's a film that I would actually go to see and whether I think I would be interested and happy making the costumes. I don't pick a film because it's a great costume opportunity. If the script is not great, but it's set in a great period, I wouldn't do it because I just wouldn't want to put myself through the months and months of work for something that might not be good. I would rather do costumes in a great film than great costumes in a bad film. Do you know what I mean? I actually want the finished end product to be something I'm proud of as opposed to just my costumes.
Yeah, and I love that because that means that you're doing independent films as well as big blockbusters.
Oh, I love doing independent films because that's really where you get to experiment and take risks a lot more. The bigger the budget, the harder it is to convince people to do something a little out of the ordinary. The smaller budget films are usually more out there scripts or an interesting young director. And quite often with the restrictions, financial restrictions, it does force you into really having to use your imagination maybe a lot more than just relying on, I can afford to do this, or I can afford to try this. If that doesn't work, I can do something else. It does really make you work out the best way of doing something.
I just want to give a shout out to How to Talk to Girls at Parties, which was directed by John Cameron Mitchell, who in my world is famous to me because of Hedwig and the Angry Inch. And I never would have heard of this movie if I hadn't come upon it through your research. So I got to watch it, and it's so incredible. And again, just one of those lower budget films, but you were so inventive with the costumes set in the 1980s punk world.
It was 1970s, actually, set in 1977, which is the golden jubilee of the Queen at the time. I'm really happy that some of those costumes have survived, and they're not going to live forever because they're latex, and latex perishes. But I'm really happy we've got them in our exhibition, and that it will draw people's attention to a film that actually wasn't seen by that many people. So I'm very happy that's going to be put on the map and be watched. It's crazy. It's really mad, but it's such good fun. Yeah.
It's such good fun. It's 1970s punk meets basic. It's sci-fi. It's aliens come down to Earth, and they have this. It's a love story. It's all of these things, and there's these really wacky, wonderful costumes. But there's also wonderful punk costumes. Nicole Kidman in her zippered and safety pinned ruff. All these like Vivian Westwood references and pieces. So definitely check it out, Dress listeners. And that was really a treat. So we've been looking back at your career with this retrospective. And in closing, are there any stories that you still hope to tell in the future? Because you're not done making costumes. You're not done designing.
Absolutely not. There are many stories I want to tell, but I actually can't say I want to do the film about this or I want to do the film about that. I'm hoping that I will be given the opportunity to do more of what I've been doing and what I love doing. You know, I really am. I'm open to offers. I'm open to doing anything.
Well, Sandy, thank you so much for being here. This has been such a treat.
Thank you.
Sandy, thank you so much for taking us behind the scenes, as we always like to say, of your incredible career. And Cass, you actually got to go see this exhibition in person and were part of the educational programming of it, yes?
Yes, I was at the invitation of the museum and Assistant Director of Fashion Exhibitions, Emily Smith, who treated me to an absolutely wonderful experience getting to know the SCAD Fashion Museum and SCAD's Atlanta campus. So SCAD is the Savannah College of Art and Design. They have a campus in Savannah, campus in Atlanta, and a campus in La Coste, France.
Yeah.
But I had never been. And so they really treated me to a really special, special time. And a special shout out to Rachel for arranging my trip and Hannah for taking me around. Hannah took me around. I went and talked to students and I went to the exhibition preview and opening. And then I actually got to interview Sandy for a live event with a lot of their membership. And that was really special and cool. So thank you to everyone for having me. And yeah, check out this exhibition. It's really, really wonderful to see Sandy's designs up close in person.
We actually quite enjoy doing these museum and kind of institutional collaborations. Listeners, you know who you are out there if you're listening. So hit us up. We do these several times a year. So looking to do more in 2025, perhaps.
Yes.
You also have plenty of time, as I said earlier, to check out the exhibition in person at SCAD Fashion in Atlanta. It is up until March 16th, 2025. And you also have plenty of time to start watching Sandy Powell's films. There are so many past films to watch and future films to look forward to. And Cass, you didn't get to talk about it, but Sandy has two films coming out next year, which include Disney's live-action version of Snow White and also Maggie Gyllenhaal's The Bride, which is a 1930s Chicago spin on Frankenstein.
Yeah.
This is going to be fun and weird and creepy for sure.
Yeah, and absolutely amazing because Sandy is on board with the costume. So looking forward to that. And on that note, Dress listeners, I think that does it for us today. Until next time, may you consider the storytelling capabilities of your clothing next time you get dressed.
Dress listeners, you can head to our show notes and find links to the exhibition's website, also Sandy's Instagram, where she posts regularly. And she really takes us behind the scene of her life and also her work. And our show notes is also where you can find all of the links to our favorite fashion history titles on our Dress bookshelf. That's at bookshop.org. And it features over 150 different fashion history titles, which you might like to put on your holiday gift wish list.
Yes. And Dress listeners, we love hearing from you. So please feel free to reach out to us at hello@dressedhistory.com. Dressedhistory.com is, of course, our website where you will find information about our upcoming classes, tours, anything else we have up our finely tailored sleeves, which will very shortly include our next listing for our next class with Dress the School of Fashion, which is going to be co-taught by April and I on the 1950s Golden Age of Haute Couture. And we will be announcing our Dress Fashion History 2025 Tour of Paris very soon. We've actually heard from many of you who want to come, so watch that space because that will sell out quickly.
Yes. And also, if you want to be on the pre-notification email blast to get notified when that's live first, you can send us an email at hello@dressedhistory.com and we will get you on that list as well. Also, if you would like to find the visual content connected to each of our week's episodes, you can follow us on Instagram at @dressed_podcast. And the content specifically connected to this episode can be found at #dressed520. That's #dressed520. love Dressed but want to skip the ads, consider subscribing to the ad-free version of the show for just $3 a month, and that link is in our show notes as well. As always, thank you for your continued support. More Dressed coming your way soon. Dressed, the History of Fashion, is a production of Dressed Media.
How do you feel when you switch to Geico and save on your car insurance? It's like going to work on one Thursday morning and thinking to yourself, just one more day until Friday. But then somebody in the elevator says, Happy Friday! Then you check your phone quickly and discover today's actually Friday. So yes, Happy Friday, random stranger in the elevator. Happy Friday indeed. Yep, switching and saving with Geico feels just like that. Get more with Geico. How do you feel when you switch to Geico and save on your car insurance? It's like going to work on one Thursday morning and thinking to yourself, just one more day until Friday. But then somebody in the elevator says, Happy Friday! Then you check your phone quickly and discover today's actually Friday. So yes, Happy Friday, random stranger in the elevator. Happy Friday indeed. Yep, switching and saving with Geico feels just like that. Get more with Geico.